from the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Diane Cook, whose novel, The New Wilderness, comes out from Harper tomorrow, which is Tuesday, August 11th. The book has been long listed for the Booker Prize. Diane Cook is also the author of the story collection Man v. Nature, which was a finalist for the Guardian First Book Award, the Believer Book Award, and the Los Angeles Times Art Seidenbaum Award for First Fiction. Her writing has appeared in Harper's, Tin House, Granta, and other publications, and her stories have been included in the anthologies Best American Short Stories and the O. Henry Prize Stories. She's a former producer for the radio program This American Life and was the recipient of a 2016 fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. She lives in Brooklyn, New York, with her husband, daughter, and son. Actually, during our interview, you might hear her two-month-old son, who sat in his mom's lap briefly at the beginning of our conversation. Here's a little information about The New Wilderness, which Emily St. John Mandel has called a virtuosic debut, brutal and beautiful in equal measure. Bee's 5-year-old daughter Agnes is slowly wasting away, consumed by the smog and pollution of the overdeveloped metropolis that most of the population now calls home. If they stay in the city, Agnes will die. There's only one alternative, the wilderness state. The last swath of untouched, protected land where people have always been forbidden until now. Bee, Agnes, and 18 others volunteer to live in the wilderness state, guinea pigs in an experiment to see if humans can exist in nature without destroying it. Living as nomadic hunter-gatherers, they slowly and painfully learn to survive in an unpredictable, dangerous land, bickering and battling for power and control as they betray and save one another. But as Agnes embraces the wild freedom of this new existence, Bee realizes that saving her daughter's life means losing her in a different way. The farther they get from civilization, the more their bond is tested in astonishing and heartbreaking ways. When I spoke to Diane Cook last week, I began by mentioning the unusual opening of The New Wilderness, in which two people die very different deaths in quick succession, so that the reader's first experience with the book is reading the interesting and unusual ways that the narrator and other characters react to these deaths. I thought that was a really interesting way for the book to open, and I asked Diane to talk about beginning in this way, if this had always been the novel's opening, or if she changed it after she began to draft the novel. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
You know, the beginning was always the first, you know, the very first scene of the book. It was the very first thing I ever wrote for the book.
Okay, interesting.
And it always remained the beginning until probably like a couple months before I handed it in, I suddenly thought, wait, can I start a book this way? Can I really do this? And then I had a like panic moment, and then I realized, no, I had to, because I think it establishes establishes the things that Bee is all about. And it makes you understand her a little bit more as the book goes on.
Yeah.
It gives you like a little empathy for her. And I think sometimes during the course of the book, you need that for Bee because she's a little prickly of a character.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was the next thing I was going to bring up, actually. So Bee is your narrator in the first section, and she and her family have moved into the new wilderness, basically in hopes that this pristine environment will help her sick daughter survive. But I just love Bee. I think she's very relatable and sometimes unlikable, but practical. And I don't know how likable I would be in this situation. You know, I kept thinking about that as whenever she would kind of rub me the wrong way, I'm like, but on the other hand, this is her life. Right.
She is surviving in the wilderness and gave up everything for
right
for this opportunity.
That's yeah. And I think one really early kind of almost throwaway line, but if you kind of think about it, there's this moment that says that she chose to sleep with Agnes's biological father, who's not the gentleman on the trip with them, because he would be basically gone the next day, and she liked her life and she liked her job and she really didn't want anything interrupting her life, which is very ironic in the end.
Right.
But it was such a great establishment of who she was and what she was about before all of this started. And I thought that was also useful as a reader.
Yeah, setting her up to be the kind of, setting her up to be, you know, this person who takes you through at least part of the novel and really needs you, needs the reader to be with her at certain times, and was an interesting challenge. And I always felt very connected to be related to her, but I knew that some readers would have trouble with some of the choices that she makes, so I really wanted her to be as human as possible.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if you want to talk any more about developing her character, because she's so vital in the book, so incredible, and so she's such a huge presence. I don't mean just because you set her up that way, but just because that's how her character comes across. She's very important to the reader, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she and Agnes are the central characters of the book.
Right.
So I wanted each of them and their relationship to be as multifaceted, complex, and real as possible. So I spent a lot of time just trying to make them people and humans, and letting the things happen to them in the book that I thought would happen, not necessarily that I wanted to happen.
Right.
Given who they were, you know, becoming as I was writing. So I don't know. It's a really exciting relationship to write about,
yeah,
and really wonderful characters to develop, and I miss them now that I'm not writing them still.
Yeah, I do feel like there's this wonderful exploration of motherhood in this book, and not just between Bea and Agnes, but also Bea is missing her own mother, who she had to leave to go on this journey, and that becomes very important ultimately too. And then Agnes watches Bea so closely, and Agnes is starting to approach adolescence, and so you can kind of see that she's gonna, you know, be, you know, in our society she would just kind of turn into a big pain and have her face in her phone and not
right.
talk. But this is very interesting to watch how she deals with her mother and the way she wants to reject her mother but finds that she sort of can't. And I thought it was really well done, really good.
Thank you. I think, Agnes was so exciting to write. I mean, I like what you just said, that nowadays she just has her face in her phone, which I understood on some level, but I think I wasn't even totally appreciating that, how different her life would be now. I think partly because I grew up without technology, so that's like the base of what I know. And obviously, as you've heard, my kids are too young, so I haven't reached that point yet
yeah.
with them. So my base model is like my mom and me, and like that kind of our relationship. Not that it's based on us, but just like just the mysteriousness of that relationship sometimes. Like, we were close, but there was always... there's just things you don't know about your mother, and there's things as a mother you don't know about your daughter, and like, you're these two separate beings trying to be as close as two people can be,
right,
in some ways.
Right.
And it doesn't always, it's not automatic. I mean, that's the thing that I find so interesting about familial relationships, is that, yes, it's an automatic love, but it's not an automatic, like, knowledge. You still have to know these people and figure out how to know these people. And that sometimes that doesn't work.
Right.
Sometimes it remains mysterious. And I feel like that's like a harder thing to grapple with for some reason. I think because the expectation is that you're family and you know each other so in depth, and so deeply, but it doesn't always feel that way.
Right. It's almost like a setup because you feel like it should be so easy because you do have this sort of built-in understanding of each other, and it should be easy, and so often it's not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely.
Now, one line jumped out at me when I was reading. Their being in the wilderness is an experiment. It's a government study, basically, in sort of civilian survival in the wilderness. At one point, I think it must be B who reflects, it had seemed like such a game at the beginning. I loved that. And I loved the kind of like surreal nature of what it must have felt like to them at the beginning. And I have to say, there was an awful lot about this book that kind of reminded me of our experience now of COVID-19 and the quarantine and all the kind of surreal otherworldly stuff that's happening to us. Has that occurred to you as your book is launching?
Yeah, although, yes, it has. And people have told me that too. Now that it's like almost out, more and more people are getting their hands on it, early copies, and hearing about it and reading it. And that's like some feedback I'm getting a lot of. I think when I was writing it, I didn't have pandemic in mind at all. In my mind, like the way that the characters reach this point in society, the way that the future society evolves to be like this, I never thought of pandemic as getting us there. So it like took me a while to really connect with right now, to connect the book with right now. But I think like, yes, this idea of, I mean, even just this sense of escaping what ails society, and escaping what the greater society is like having to grapple with.
Right.
And that being a way to survive, really does resonate now. The book really like speaks to that.
Right.
I mean, I think of all the, I live in Brooklyn, New York, in a really small apartment, in a building with lots of other people. And this idea that like a lot of people in cities, in the city especially, like left right when the pandemic hit to get somewhere else, like away from people. I think it's just this like instinct we have, you know, to like a bit like flee the danger.
Yeah.
And what I always found most interesting and satisfying about the book is that they are fleeing one danger into another. It's just a different kind of danger, like a totally elemental kind of danger. Whereas what they're fleeing in the city is somewhat stated, but like you never get a full sense of really what's so awful about being there, except for like that it's hurting Agnes. But I wanted there to be a little bit of ambiguity because I think every reader brings their own like deeper fears to the book, and different people's thresholds for what would make them run away or want to flee is different. So I wanted to kind of leave that up to the reader a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never felt confused about it, but you're right. It's not very specific, is it? It's, it's definitely about the environment and the changing environment and pollution. But you're right. It doesn't go very, very specific. And even when there's an opportunity for somebody who has kind of experienced the city again and then brings that knowledge back, even then there's like a reluctance to talk about specifically what they saw, which I thought was interesting. Let's see. One of my favorite things about this novel is how you play with the personification of nature and the kind of opposite of that of actual characters. I don't want to say dehumanization, but they become part of this natural landscape in a way that I found just incredibly well written and beautiful. Do you mind if I just mention a few lines?
Oh, yeah, of course, please.
So, this one's pretty obvious, but Agnes is like a colt, bounding and curious. Then another moment, B sat on the edge of the playa and watched the fine sand of the dry lake kick up in short-lived swirling dust devils, at first excited and then dying down as though realizing there was nothing to be excited about. The hawk cries came from above, whining, "Go away, go away." The moon crawled farther out of its den. There's so many examples of the nature being kind of personified, which I loved, but also, I think we see less of this in literature. There were just incredibly beautiful examples of the characters being described in a way that made me remember they were in this wilderness. And I don't know that I have as many examples of that, but did that become a very conscious thing that you were doing, or did that just kind of come naturally as you were working?
It's like hard even now to parse like which came first, the chicken or the egg. But
yeah,
I always wanted to. One of the things that I really like doing as a writer is remembering that people are animals, and we're just on this like very far end of the spectrum from like say you know a raccoon or something. So it's something that I play with a lot in my writing. So putting them in this situation, putting a bunch of kind of modern day humans in a situation where they have to suddenly interact and with and live off the land, I knew would make them have to grapple with their more animal nature if that's all they're seeing. You know, like we're like a product of our culture, and in the wilderness state, their culture is they're like the culture of animals. It's all they see. It's like being influenced by the television that you watch, but that's their television is just what's around them. So I knew that they would be influenced by that. And I think that was probably one of the big projects of the book was just, or I mean, experiments of the book was what if you had people live like that, fully immersed in nature, what would they learn and how would it affect their like personhood? So it was definitely a conscious thing for me. And probably like different characters begin to embody that more than other characters. Like Agnes was always to me a really interesting case study because she is so young when she arrives in the wilderness state. So I knew that she was going to be the example of, you know, a kind of native speaker where it's something that she learns so young that it just becomes who she is. Mm-hmm. Whereas other characters, you know, their relationship with the place is a little different, like just like say B, because they didn't grow up there. They have this whole different reference point, this different place that made them who they were. And Agnes has the wilderness state. It really is like where she is. She's not born there, but she becomes who she is there. Mm-hmm. And that who she is just someone who is almost impossible to separate out from like the animal and natural world around her. She's just a part of it.
Right, right. This line, and it's funny, I'm trying to remember why this line struck me this way, but there's a moment where Agnes is disappointed by something that B does. And you write, she gathered that cold, fearful feeling into her gut and held it there, squeezing until it was hard and compact, a new part of her. And for some reason, that moment just really made me feel like it was one of those things where she's just becoming very organic to this landscape and she's taking in her emotions. And that was one of a piece, I thought, with who she was. Does that strike you as being a similar thing to what we're talking about?
Yes. Well, it actually like also reminds me of one of your earlier questions about, I think maybe one of the first questions, maybe when I still had my baby in my lap. So just this idea that like they very quickly have to, or they become like a little bit, not desensitized, but they have to learn to grapple with their feelings differently as time wears on while they're there. And the example that we used earlier was like that, like actual deaths occur and the the characters in the book kind of have to, they grapple with it in probably surprising ways. We would find the readers living in our lives right now would find them very surprising. But at the time that we're reading about the characters, they've been in the wilderness state for years, and they've really sort of become, they've had to cultivate like completely different coping skills, and a different sense and a different order of like how they need to be and how they need to grieve and how they need to take care of one another. They've learned that the ways that they would have done it in the city are different. Mm-hmm. They have to adapt and evolve to the landscape and the life that they're living now. And I think Agnes is in that same, has to do that same thing. And possibly like with that line that you just read about needing to push it down. I mean, there's something possibly like a little emotionally sensitive about Agnes. Mm-hmm. And I think it is because the one thing that I think it's harder to parse when you're watching the natural world is where the emotion is. Mm-hmm. And I personally don't think that it isn't there. I think, you know, I think it's animals have emotions, and I think that the natural world can be full of it, but I think as people, it's harder to see and harder to really distinguish it.
Right. So, right. The first thing that comes to mind for me when you say that is playfulness. Like you'll see playfulness in nature and you know, like, okay, those lion cubs are playing that you see, you know, film mm-hmm. of, but anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. And like, and you'll hear about examples in nature of like animals grieving. Mm-hmm. But it's because we don't speak the language, it's very hard to understand the depths of either of those feelings. And I think that Agnes, that's something that she, it's maybe like a hole for her development a little bit, because her mother, B, is not exactly always emotionally forthcoming, or she is hot and cold, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like she's very present and full of love, and then she turns it off. I mean, not on mm-hmm. purpose. I just think it's how she is.
Just to survive.
And so Agnes is trying to figure out how to be, it's like interesting. She's almost trying to figure out how to be human because her first instinct is, because of just how she's grown up, is to be more her animal self. And maybe like the great mystery of her mother is that her mother is more human than anything else.
Yeah.
And she just can't totally understand her.
That's interesting. Yeah, I like that. Now, one thing I wanted to talk about, and we're kind of there, but I wanted to talk about how each of these characters is such a great narrator and for very different reasons. I mean, B tells it like it is. There is absolutely nothing coy about her. And Agnes is she's a child, and even more childlike perhaps than she would have been at her own age in another society. And so she sees things very clearly. As we said, she's more a part of nature. She sees things without the sophistication that might make an adult's narration feel over-explained using the same words. So, like, it was just really interesting to me to see you change the point of view from the early part of the book to later, from B to Agnes. I wonder if you want to talk at all about that.
Yeah, I remember it took me a while to figure out how to tell both of their stories. I knew that it was, that they were going to be like the two dominant voices, but I had lots of fits and starts on how to do that. As I was beginning to write, like maybe for the first couple of years I was writing, I just couldn't get away from B's voice. Like everything I would write would end up being her.
Right.
And I remembered also there was like, I had like chunks of first person narration. I had chunks of third. So I was trying to figure out like between first and third, and nothing was nothing was consistent in my writing. I knew Agnes needed to be in there, but I just like couldn't access her. And then I had all of these like almost embarrassing little like, well, maybe like tricks up my sleeve. Like maybe by the end of the book, you'll discover that, you know, you think it's B the whole time, but it's really Agnes. Like I had like, I was like trying to figure out all these like weird ways to trick the reader into.
I think that's the best thing about, that's the best thing about an MFA program. You'll have an advisor that says no.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, I was out of the MFA at this point, so I had to figure this out all on my own. But one, I remember one day, and I was really kind of getting to the end of my rope as far as, like, I just knew the book wasn't working in some big way.
Wow.
And I might have started to panic a little bit. And I remember, like, I had a week that I went away. Sometimes I would just, like, rent a cabin somewhere or borrow someone's house. This is before I had kids, to just, like, get away and write. And I went away and I just opened up a whole new document and I called it like experiment with Agnes narrating, just cause I knew like I had to let myself off the hook if I was going to make the leap. Like I had to know that I could scrap it. It had to be an experiment. I had to be able to fail. Right.
Right. I can throw this away.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I just started writing, and that's what begins that part of the book.
Okay.
The Ballad of Agnes. And it just kind of, I think just once I let myself play with it and play around, then I was finally okay to just let her take over the book. Because at that point, you know, I've been working on it for a couple of years and you're pretty invested. I think it's a weird turning point in writing a book. You're really invested in it working because you spent so much time on it.
Right.
And that can almost make you start to like panic a little bit with some of the choices. And I think I just needed a little bit of a restart and a little bit of a kind of permission to keep messing it up and permission to be wrong or make mistakes or write a whole section that didn't work in order to like jump over that and actually get to a new part of the book that was working.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit. You have an aspect of the story is a presence in the story is the Rangers. And, you know, if there's any sort of human bad guy. That's how I associated the Rangers, and I suppose that's not quite fair to them. But
I know.
But anyway, so how did that come about, and how did you? I mean, it was just very organic to the plot that there should be some sort of overseeing force that keeps them in line and creates rules and also messes with them sometimes. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I always knew that there needed to be kind of that enforcer role. And thinking about the wilderness state, it just made sense that they would be not police so much as like, you know, stewards of the wilderness. I think at first, they evolved. And I mean, without giving too much away, like, at first they seem, you know, just kind of maybe like prickly people.
Right.
And you don't really understand their power.
Right.
In the landscape necessarily. And that becomes very clear as the story goes on. And
yeah.
That was something I discovered as I was writing that they weren't going to be a benign force in the community members' lives. It's not something I totally understood at the beginning. And in fact, like one of the first rangers you meet is this character named Ranger Bob.
Right.
And he's like a really good friend to be. And they have a really good relationship. And he's this very kindly man in the way that I, you know, always imagined a ranger in a wilderness area would be, and if I know them to be. And I've always felt a little bad writing the ranger characters because I didn't want people to automatically like imagine park rangers.
You threw them all under the bus.
I know. but I mean, but it, they had to be rangers, of course, in a wilderness area. So with apologies to the National Park Service, workers and rangers, it's not you. It's just the name.
Right.
But I oh, so Ranger Bob. Ranger Bob's one of the earliest ones you meet, and he's really kindly. And that always was, you know, that was always the case with him in my mind. And I think probably aside from, you know, some of the more dour rangers, that was all it was going to be in my head. It was like kind of a little bit of an ineffectual force in their life, like that was just kind of handing down rules and making them move along as they needed to walk from place to place, but didn't have much more power than that. And that changes over the course of the book, and it changed for me over the course of writing the book, and that was a really exciting development. That's like, it's always, I mean, this was one of the first things I've written where I had a pretty thought through outline. Like I kind of knew where the book was going to go. I think In writing the novel, I just had to, it's just such a sprawling project that yes. I needed some guidelines. But the trick is always to like still have the writing experience be full of surprises. Right. Even as you're following a path. So the development of the rangers and their, and kind of what they stand for was a really exciting part for me, because it was a surprise and it kept me on track, but it made the book a lot richer, I think.
Yeah. Now you just mentioned that you had ultimately made an outline. I'm also curious, did you map this? Like, were these places that you had in your mind, or were you just kind of having a kind of amorphous landmass that they lived on?
Mm-hmm. A little bit of both.
Okay.
I definitely, you know, at some point I thought, or maybe someone suggested, like, should I just draw this map of the place? And I thought, I can't, because yeah. I'm not sure it would make any sense.
Right, okay.
But it roughly makes sense in my head. And it's roughly based in an area of eastern Oregon, like the high desert of eastern Oregon, that I spent a lot of time there. And the landscape is a lot of what inspires the landscape in the book. But I just take bits and pieces of things that I've seen in a lot of the West, but especially the high desert of the West, and kind of patchwork it together as places that they walk to. And the place that they are in is much more vast than just saying like part of, you know, like the southeast corner of Oregon. So it's almost fantastical how large the landmass can feel for them. And that's something I just let happen in the book as I was writing, and I didn't want to kind of tether myself to a real place and real boundaries. I just wanted it to feel like an endless place, because that's what it felt like to them.
Right.
And their borders and boundaries kind of ceased to be important at some point, aside from the fact that they're in the place that they're in, and no one else can be there. You know, that there's a border that keeps people out as opposed to keeping them in necessarily.
Yeah. Let's see. So it was interesting to see. So there are other children in the book, and it was interesting to see them being raised outside the world that their parents knew. So it was kind of fun when I would come across a line like, "What's traffic?" they ask. And at another point, you know, one of them says, "What's a shower?" And it made me think of how hard it must be, for example, to be an immigrant raising your children outside of your home country and trying to give a sense of what your culture is. But then immigration, I thought that you had a little bit of a nod to that in the future that you're seeing here with the Latin names, Flor and Joven and Maria and Dolores and Linda. You know, there's a lot of a Latin presence in the people, and that just sort of to me established or confirmed sort of that this is a trajectory that's in our future. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was something that I didn't set out to try and do. That definitely came from like the real world seeping in as I was writing the book.
Right.
Especially towards the end of writing the book was where suddenly immigration became a huge, not suddenly, but like it became this issue in the 2016 election, where I think like I entered into like election season before Trump was a candidate or elected. I entered in not really understanding that was a major issue anymore. I just, it seemed like there were bigger problems people had, and that he just turned it into immigration into this huge issue was so shocking to me. And then the ways that it became this crisis on the border, and the way that he talked about the border, and the way that he talked about us and them. And it really started to enter into the book.
Mm-hmm.
Not even so much about the Latin, the Spanish names. So not so much about like the Spanish names or the Spanish language that enters into the book, but it was more about this idea of like who belongs where,
right.
And the community members who live in the wilderness state become suddenly very protective of their status there and of the potential for other people entering. And that was definitely like coming from the outside world, this feeling of like a protectionism, that was coming up in the rhetoric around the election, just around mm-hmm. like politics, and society in the United States.
Yeah.
The Spanish language stuff was part of that too, but also it was coming from my husband is Puerto Rican, and
mm-hmm.
my daughter is being raised bilingual, and my daughter, like the dominant force in her life as far as family is definitely going to be on the Puerto Rican side.
Uh-huh.
And I think there was also this thing that was happening in me as a mom writing that I wanted her to feel represented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm white and, very like suburban American. I'm represented in everything I read. Aside from being a woman, I don't find a lot of texts that I can't, find myself in, but suddenly having a daughter who might feel like who was going to have this other language that she has a close connection to, and a different kind of, and another culture that she has a close relationship to. I started to be very cognizant of the absence of that in the book. And wanted it to be there. So I think there are these two forces that were happening. And also I was having to speak a lot more Spanish. So it was naturally kind of coming into the world and the dialogue. So there were all these different forces kind of entering into my mind and heart and coming into the book in that way. I wanted it. And there's also like a, you know, in my vision, the book is very diverse. Although I don't generally describe my characters, and I usually try and make them seem as generic as possible because I want a reader to be able to put themselves in there. And I don't want there to be a lot of details that distract them from being able to do that.
Right.
But as the book went on and I had my daughter and I started to think about representation, and then started to think about immigration, like it became very clear that I needed to have a more obvious presence of like a Spanish speaking population. Especially just thinking about what America will look like in the future. So that maybe more distinguishing characteristics started to seep in, and that felt important to me.
I wanted to, I like to ask my guests always what they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners, other people's works. Do you have anything that comes to mind? I know you've been really busy lately.
I have been really busy. that hasn't been my best time for reading. But actually I've read maybe, I think because I have a lot of friends whose books have come out this year. It's just been a very wild year for books. For lots of reasons. So I have been reading quite a bit, but yeah, I've had a lot on my plate, as we all have. One of my favorite books of the year is written by a friend, so I'm just going to plug it. It's called Temporary by Hilary Leichter.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful, again, like a speculative book about kind of the absurdity and a horrific version of the gig economy.
Okay.
It's about a woman who is a temporary, like she's a temp, but her jobs are just the most absurd jobs. But it's just this future or imagined or fantastic world where one of her, you know, jobs could be being a barnacle.
Oh my god.
Rock. And or like a pirate on a pirate ship.
Wow.
Everything has this veneer of like, well, it's just a job, it's just work, you know, this is my work. But they're so totally absurd jobs. But it's like this also this really human book about wanting something stable. It's just a beautiful book too. It's beautifully written and funny and strange and lovely.
Okay, great.
And another book I read recently that I really loved was A Children's Bible by Lydia Millett. It's a climate change fiction, climate change novel. It's not so much set in a faraway future at all. It's kind of in the now.
Oh, wow.
But it's like about this group of friends and all their kids who are like renting a house for the summer, and there's a huge storm that comes through and it's like a hugely damaging kind of world changing storm. And it's, the book is all about how they deal with that and the ramifications of that, but it's told from the perspective of the kids. They're like teenagers, and it just opens up the potential for that kind of story so much to have it through their perspective. And it very much, it's very interesting because it's their future, and they see the way that they see their parents and they see the world, and they see even the storm and the aftermath is so particular and nuanced and interesting. It's just like a really cool take on like a climate disaster story.
Okay, wow.
And it's also very funny.
Oh, that's great. What about writing? Have you started another project or are you waiting for a bit?
I have not started another project yet. I feel like this week was the first time I actually started to think creatively about that.
Okay.
I haven't started another project, but I've been like, it's been hard for me to let this one go a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So I've been like playing around with writing, like trying to adapt it into some other form, like a TV show.
Oh, cool.
So I've been like playing around with the idea of writing this screenplay for it.
Okay, good. So I have one last question for you. I always like to end with a question about advice, and I hope I'm going to be able to convey this this question. But in your case, I wanted to ask you, you did this incredible thing. I want to actually study it. I just thought it was really interesting. You sometimes will give us, so something happens in the plot, and then I'm expecting things to go a certain way, and instead you jump in and give us something else. So let me just give you this is a tiny example, but at one point Agnes gets her period. And, you know, I thought we were going to have a scene where she's going to tell people about this and deal with head and figure out how you deal with this in the wilderness, which is, you know, something that would have made sense. On the other hand, as readers, we can figure out what's going to happen next there. And instead of doing that, you back up to something that had happened a few pages ago, and you finish the scene with that last problem. So she had been cutting someone's hair, and now after she discovers she's got her period, she suddenly notices some hairs on her outfit, and she brushes them off of her body. And she's thinking again about that. And it was just really interesting to deal with this moment in that way. And it was much more about a larger world than it was about a certain situation. And so I don't know if that's a hard thing to give advice about, but I wondered if you have advice about it, just sort of like developing plot and not doing it in necessarily expected or predictable ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I think one of the things I always try and push myself to do is to keep writing past where I think, the scene or the idea needs to go.
Right.
Because, I mean, in writing fiction or writing characters, writing novels, you're trying to, like, transplant a life onto the page. So just thinking about like how many thoughts you have in a day, how all the different places your brain goes to, all the different associations you make as a person. I mean, it's so vast and it's impossible to capture. But I think one of the things that I try to do most is to try and capture like a fragment of that potential, like whole person. And I think maybe in like the example that you mentioned and in this like kind of pushing past where the reader might expect it to stop, is part of that project is like, so yeah, she gets her period and she knows she might tell this person or that person. But if we know that that's going to happen and we can almost fill in the blanks of that scene, then why write it? You know, I think is like the question
right.
to me.
Right.
Why write that scene if we know it's coming? Why not write a different scene that we don't see? A scene that captures something more internal in her.
Yes.
Not the like surface tension of the story where, oh, she's becoming a woman. And she has thoughts and feelings about what that means, but actually represent those thoughts and feelings and represent that reality in new information or a scene or a gesture
right.
that is unexpected.
Yeah, and it goes into this lovely moment. It's very, even that moment is unexpected, you know, what she does once she finds the hairs. So it's just, anyway, go ahead. I interrupted you, but.
No, yeah, but yeah. So, I mean, in that moment, you know, the hairs that she's found belong to someone important to her. And it all, to me, it all like fits together in this package of she's changing, like she's becoming someone different. She's realizing that she's at the precipice of a new part of her life because of this, of her getting her period, and she knows what that means. And also she's very in tune. She's more animalistic. So There's this sense that like getting her period really means something to her because of that animal side. And so she has this very surprising reaction to this like remnant of hair from someone she cares about. It all felt a piece with the getting the period and entering this new phase of her life. But yeah, generally, yeah, I'd always just try and push past where you think the story is going to end or the scene is going to end. I have a book of short stories too, and that's one of the things that was the most satisfying about writing those, was realizing that like any end of the story didn't have to be the end. I could keep exploring past it until I found the true end, you know, the end that really revealed something new about the character and didn't just end the story. You know what I mean? Like
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Almost like it's this extra little gift.
And what's the name of that story collection?
It's called Man v. Nature.
Okay, that's great. I have to look at that one too. Well, Diane, I want to just mention again, the name of your beautiful new novel is The New Wilderness, published by Harper. I wish you all the best with the Booker Prize and congratulations on that either way. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It's been really nice to talk to you too.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Diane Cook. You can learn more about her work at her website, dianemariecook.com. And if you follow the Booker Prize's announcements, you'll want to check out the shortlist, which will be announced on September 15th. As I mentioned earlier in today's show, when I interviewed Diane Cook, her infant son could be heard in her lap in the early part of the hour. Then he went to be with his dad and his sister, and so his voice was no longer heard on the recording. But it got me thinking. Children fill our world, but are sometimes absent from our settings. Why is that? Do they make too much noise? Would the chaos keep your scene from working smoothly? It's a bit odd, though, right? The world is full of children, and yet it sometimes seems like I see way more dogs in literature than I do children. So this week's Write the Book prompt is to put a baby, toddler, or child in a scene. It doesn't mean necessarily introducing a new character, but maybe your narrator is at a coffee shop. Is there a cherubic baby asleep in a car seat by his mom's side at another table? Is there a young child acting up? Is there a teenager sitting with a friend in ardent conversation? Keep children in mind as you build your poetic and fictional worlds. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I hope that all of you out there are doing well enough, despite the strange times that we are in. I hope the various stages of quarantine or simple mask wearing, which I personally believe is smart and necessary, I hope that those things aren't getting to you too much. Whatever else you may be doing, I hope you are still able to read and write. If possible, I hope you're able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. For all of you who are trying to write, don't forget to check out the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a writing prompt, which is written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview, in addition to being announced at the end of each interview. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com.
If you like Write the Book, please go on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or any of your social media sites to like it, rate it, share it, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.